descrizione.
Well, it would be an easy slip to make, wouldn't it? Yeah. Yes. Design of multi-arm, multi-stage trials. So you're impinging on the frontiers of complexity there, with the sound of it. So, well,
we await you.
Okay, yes, thank you very much. So I'm going to talk about multi-arm trials, and I'm also going to talk about multi-arm trials with interim analyses, which are called multi-arm, multi-stage trials. Oh, is it called? This is the recorder. Thank you. So just to give a quick overview, I'll first talk about multi-arm trials on their own without interim analyses and why they're an area of great current interest and their advantages. Then I'll talk about three different types of multi-arm, multi-stage trial, all of which I've been involved with at some point. So group sequential MANS designs, drop the loser designs, and adaptive randomization. So I'll start with just talking about the background, which is randomized controlled trials. So this is the way things have been done for quite a while. So this is a traditional way of assessing the effectiveness of a new experimental trial. It's a randomized controlled trial. So you randomize patients between the new treatment and a control treatment. Then once you've got all the patients and you've assessed their treatment effect, their response to treatment, you do a statistical test. You test some null hypothesis that the experimental treatment is equal to or worse than the control treatment. And this has been basically the gold standard for quite a while now. I think the first proper randomized controlled trial was done by the MRC in the 40s. And since then, it's been the way to definitively test new treatments. What about multi-arm trials? Well, these are of great current interest, as they basically, nowadays in drug development, there's often a lot of drugs awaiting testing, and you could do them separately in different controlled trials, or you could test them, several of them, in a multi-arm trial. And the main advantage comes from the fact that you don't need to put so many patients on the control treatment in a multi-arm trial compared to doing separate trials. So if we have two new treatments here, then this is a lot fewer patients than doing separate trials, and all of the savings come from the control treatment. So these are more efficient than separate trials in that you need a lower sample size to test the same number of treatments, but there are some additional issues in multi-arm trials. So the first issue is, which arm should we compare? And it's not really obvious what kind of comparisons we should do in a multi-arm trial. We could compare each experimental arm versus a control arm separately. We could compare all possible pairs of arms, so comparing the experimental treatments to one another. Or we could do an omnibus test, which is where we just do a test of whether all the treatments have the same mean. And perhaps after doing that, you might test the different arms separately. So the second one, the all possible pairs of arms, that has been suggested in the past, but it's unlikely that there'll be enough power, statistical power, to detect differences between experimental treatments. You might expect very low power to detect a good treatment against a quite good treatment, for example. So there's not a huge amount of motivation for doing this. So that leaves one in three, doing an omnibus test or comparing each arm separately versus control. And the power of this, basically, the relative power of these two classes of design depends on whether there are effective arms or not. So if there are lots of effective experimental arms, you're probably more powerful using an omnibus test. But if there's only one or maybe two effective experimental arms, you're probably more powerful testing each experimental arm versus a control. And in fact, in clinical trials, generally new treatments don't work very often, so we're more likely to be in the case where we have a low number of effective treatments. So I'm going to focus on the first one, which is comparing each experimental arm versus a control separately. So the second issue is control of the type 1 error rate. So in a typical multi-arm trial, there are several null hypotheses being tested. Let's go to the situation where we're testing several experimental treatments against a control treatment. Then we've got, if the number of experimental treatments is equal to k, we've got k null hypotheses being tested. And should we account for this in the analysis? Should we do a multiple testing correction? Well, there's two main schools of thought on this. basically we should or we shouldn't. And the first one is that we shouldn't, because if we were to do several separate trials, each testing one treatment against a control, then in that case you wouldn't make a multiple testing correction. So why do we need to do it in this case? But the second one is that when we're doing an experiment, it's important to control the overall chance of making a type 1 error in the experiment, and therefore we should control the maximum probability of making a type 1 error. And this is called the family-wise error rate, the chance of making any type 1 error, that is, rejecting any true null hypothesis or recommending any ineffective experimental treatment. So what's my opinion? I tend to think that I'm more closer to the second point of view, that we should control the family-wise error rate. If we're doing a definitive trial where new treatments are going to be put into practice, I think it's important to control the family-wise error rate. If we're at an earlier stage, maybe a phase 2 trial where any treatment we find is going to be tested in further trials, maybe we don't need to control it so stringently, but I think still that the family-wise error rate is a relevant quantity to be stated. Yes?
It looks as though there are some issues associated with the control arm itself.
Okay.
Because when it is a common control arm, it sets the standard for everything else.
Yeah. If it does poorly by chance, then all of the experimental arms will appear to
be appear to be better.
Yeah.
Yeah. Than exactly. The control.
Yeah.
The other issue might be that the control arm, being based on presumably an established treatment,
yeah, or a placebo,
would be one whose effectiveness is well established.
Mm-hmm. Better than the experimental ones, anyway.
Yeah. Therefore, any major deviation within the control arm would be due to variation between the subjects that enter that control arm. So, you know, there's a tangle of issues just about that one.
Absolutely.
Trial.
Yeah, that's very true. So we tend to take into account the fact that there's variability in the control arm when we find the properties of rejecting any true null hypothesis. But even if we do that, it might still have a higher chance of recommending several arms when we shouldn't, compared to separate trials, because of the extra, or the less variability in the control arm compared to separate trials. That's a good point, yes. So maybe we should look at the false discovery rate instead of the family-wise error rate, which is the expected number of null hypotheses rejected but are true. That's something I thought about, but I've never really done anything about. So if we do choose to control the family-wise error rate by doing a full multiple testing correction, let's say if we're doing a separate trials, we've controlled the type 1 error rate at 5%, and if we're doing a multi-arm trial, we've controlled the family-wise error rate at 5%. Then if we do that, we get lower gains from using a multi-arm trial, but we still do get gains. So this is an example where, let's say we're doing a phase 2 trial with 50 patients needed per arm. So if we were to test several new treatments, we'd need 100 patients per extra treatment if we were doing separate trials. Whereas if we were doing a multi-arm trial with no adjustment, it'd just be increasing 50 each time. So we're getting bigger and bigger gains here. If we were to make a full adjustment, then we still get a gain compared to the separate trial case, but it's not as big as no adjustment. So we do lose quite a lot by doing a full adjustment for multiple testing.
What do you mean by full adjustment?
So controlling the family-wise error rate at the same value that you'd control the type 1 error rate at in a non-multi-arm case.
Is that
like Dunnett? Yeah, using Dunnett, exactly. So it would be controlled, say, at the 5% level with this is exactly assuming Dunnett, which is a way of taking the correlation between test statistics into account. Bonferroni, of course, would be worse than this because it's over-correcting compared to Dunnett. Right, if we're looking, the third issue is powering the trial. So in just a normal randomised controlled trial, this is fairly easy. We just specify a clinically relevant difference that we'd like the trial to have a high chance or high power to detect if it's truly the difference is equal to that. But it's less obvious how to power a multi-arm trial. We could power it in order to detect the best treatment or just to detect any that have a certain treatment effect. The way I tend to do it, and this has been recommended for multi-arm trials, is to use something that Dunnett calls the least favourable configuration. And this assumes that one treatment's effective with some clinically relevant difference treatment effect, and all of the other experimental treatments have some uninteresting treatment effect. This could be no difference between control and experimental, or it could be some small gain with the experimental arm. It depends on what you want to do. And then the power under the least favourable configuration is the power of recommending the effective treatments only. Well, not only, sorry, just the power of the chance of recommending the effective treatment. Okay? So those are some issues in multi-arm trials. But if you've come across group sequential trials, which basically split the trial into several stages and allow you to assess the how each treatment, well, how the treatment is doing against the control treatment and whether the trial should continue, then this leads on naturally to the idea of a multi-arm, multi-stage trial. And this basically adds interim analyses to a multi-arm trial. And it allows the information you gather during the trial on the treatment effectiveness to change the design or to make changes to which treatments are included in the trial. For example, if a certain treatment is performing very poorly, we might drop it from the trial, or we might just reduce the future allocation of patients to that treatment. We also might allow for early stopping for efficacy if we have sufficient evidence that one of the treatments is effective. That would be when we just want to find a single effective treatment as opposed to any treatment that's effective. So stopping for efficacy is more controversial than stopping for futility, because some people say, well, we want to find as many effective treatments as there are, so we don't want to stop early if one of the treatments is effective. So interim analyses add efficiency to the trial, even beyond, so a multi-arm trial adds efficiency compared to separate trials, multi-arm, multi-stage adds further efficiency, at least on average, and it also makes the trial more ethical. But there are many different ways to use the interim information to make changes. So I'm going to cover three of these in this talk. These are ones that I've been interested in myself. So one is just a straightforward application of group sequential designs to multi-arm trials. I'm going to go through these in detail later, so don't worry if you don't know what I'm talking about at the moment. The second is drop the loser designs. And the third is adaptive randomization, which maybe you've come across in the past. So firstly, I'm going to talk about group sequential multi-arm trials. So a paper by Dunnett was basically what he did was look at a multi-arm case where you've got several experimental arms and a control arm, and he derived the joint distribution of the test statistics testing each experimental arm versus a control arm. And thus, this gives a way of finding the family-wise error rate exactly. So it's just the probability of making any type 1 error, so 1 minus the probability of not making a type 1 error. And this paper has been extended quite nicely to multi-arm trials with interim analyses. Last year, a paper in Biometrica. And this design basically involves specifying binding futility and efficacy stopping boundaries. So binding just means that you have to follow them if you want to control the type 1 error and power of the trial at the level you specified. And if you don't follow them, then it could lead to inflation or deflation in the type 1 error or power. So at each interim analysis, we calculate test statistics that test each experimental arm against the control arm separately. Each of those test statistics, so it depends on the type of data. If we're doing if we're looking at normally distributed data, then we just look at the t-test or something like that. If we're doing survival data, we'd look at the log rank test or something like that. If those test statistics are below the futility boundary, I'm assuming lower values is worse, so this experimental arm is worse, means lower values. So if it's below the futility boundary, then we drop that treatment for futility. And if above the efficacy boundary, then we can stop the trial with the conclusion that that treatment's effective. That's not the only way of doing it. You could just stop that arm, or you could not allow stopping for efficacy at all. So it would look a bit like this. For a three-stage design, we have So the analysis is on the x-axis, so we've got three analyses. These two are interim analyses, and that's the final analysis. And we've got the test statistic scale on the y-axis. So let's say that we have some design specified in the green and red lines. So the red lines represent the futility boundaries. Those three only need to specify three of them. So this determines when we stop the futility at the first stage, at the second stage, etc. And the efficacy boundaries are in green, and you can notice they're going down. So at the first stage, we recruit a third of the total number of patients that we plan to recruit, and we do statistical tests, testing each of the experimental arms against the control arm, and we get something like this. So this is the orange treatment, and you can't really see that very clearly, but that's the light blue treatment there. So this one is below the futility boundary, so that one will get dropped for futility. We wouldn't recruit any more patients to that in the future. None of them are above the efficacy boundary, so we haven't found any significant difference yet. We're going to just continue with these three treatments. So we recruit further patients to each arm, and we might see something like this. So now the purple treatment is below the futility boundary. That would get dropped for futility. But now we've actually got one that's above the efficacy boundary, so we can reject the null hypothesis associated with the orange treatment, and we can say the orange treatment's significantly better than control, and we can stop the trial. Or we could just continue with that treatment and see where that is in the final stage, because it's not clear at the moment if it's significantly better than control or not. Any questions on that?
Yes, what's the difference between the three stages?
Okay, so basically it just means that we recruit a certain number of patients, and then once they're all assessed, we do an interim analysis. Here we recruit further patients if we're continuing the trial, and after those patients have been assessed, we do a second interim analysis.
But is that interim analysis the same as the first one?
It's not the same. Well, it's calculating the same test statistics, but on all of the patients recruited. So we've got more patients between here and here. We've got two-thirds of the total number of patients here and one-third here. And this is just after all patients have been recruited. Is that any clearer?
Oh, so when you get to all patients recruited,
yeah,
the width of your acceptance interval, yeah, or your thing is zero.
That's right. So we don't want to continue past the first stage.
To make a decision like that.
Exactly, yeah. That's because we don't want to continue anymore. So
yeah,
what I've seen in the literature, people leave a gap here sometimes, yeah, and that's when we're not sure, and maybe we want to do further trials.
So in fact, the width between those two curves does not represent the true uncertainty.
The true uncertainty in the test statistic?
Yeah.
In the effectiveness of the treatment. Not really, no, it doesn't.
Because if it did, you couldn't have the meeting on stage three.
No, it doesn't represent the uncertainty, no. So the choice of these boundaries is very important because it influences the type 1 error, the family-wise error rate, the power, and other properties of the design. So together with the choice of boundaries, the sample size that we recruit per arm per stage basically determines the power and the family-wise error rate. So if we wanted a target family-wise error rate, perhaps 5%, and a target power, perhaps 90%, then there are infinitely many possible shapes we could use. And that what I'm saying there is, there's an infinite number of futility boundaries and efficacy boundaries and sample size recruited that have those properties. So we need a further way of distinguishing the designs. So often in group sequential designs with a single experimental treatment, the expected sample size is of interest. And this is just the average sample size used by the design if it were repeated over and over. So we're going to use that in this multi-arm setting as well. So if we denote delta K to be the difference in treatment effect between experimental arm K and the control arm, and we've got a vector of treatment effects, and sorry, I've got the closed brackets there, then the expected sample size depends on this vector of treatment effects. Because for very low values of delta, it means that the trial is highly likely to stop early for futility, because the test statistics will have a very low mean. For high values of delta, or even if just one of them is very high, then we're very likely to stop the trial early for efficacy. So that, in that sense, the expected sample size will be very low, Whereas if delta's close to zero around that area, we're less likely to stop early for futility or efficacy, and the expected sample size is higher. So this leads to the idea of an optimal design, which is one that meets the family-wise error rate and power constraints, but minimises the expected sample size at some vector delta. And again, there's actually an infinite number of optimal designs, because for each possible value of delta, there's an optimal design associated with it. So I'm just in the work I did, I just restricted my attention to three of these. So these are what we call a global null optimal design, which is optimal when all of the treatments have effect zero, so all of the experimental arms have the same effect as the control treatment. There's the least favourable configuration optimal design, which is optimal under the least favourable configuration. That's when one of the treatments is effective and the rest are ineffective. And there's the delta minimax design, which basically aims to minimise the maximum expected sample size. So here's an example of an expected sample size, and the peak of the curve would be the maximum expected sample size, and that design would aim to minimise that. So we recently published a paper on finding optimal designs, and this is quite a difficult problem, not one I'm going to talk about in this talk. I could talk about it for quite a long time on its own, but if you're interested in that, then that's available open access in Statistics in Medicine. So here's the expected sample size as the mean treatment effect of the first treatment varies, and we're setting all of the others. I'm sorry for the notation I haven't introduced. This is a bit out of context, this diagram, but this just means that all of the treatments except the first one have the uninteresting treatment effect. There might be zero, for example, and we vary the effect of the first treatment, the effective treatment. So here, that means the first treatment's ineffective, and this means it's highly effective. So the four lines here show the expected sample sizes of the three different optimal designs that I discussed, and also one called the triangular design, which just has a fixed shape, and it's very easy to find. So we're interested in seeing whether all of this work finding optimal designs was worth it or not. So if you look at the blue line, at the very low values of delta, this performs well. It's got the best expected sample size, but it performs pretty less well when one of the treatments is affected, because it's less likely to stop early for efficacy, but more likely to stop early for futility. The least favourable configuration performs better over here, this is the least favourable configuration, so it's optimal there. But the other two designs there perform almost as well. I quite like the delta minimax design in black. It performs well for the whole range of treatment effects, and it's got the lowest peak there. So by controlling the peak, it controls the surrounding values as well. Yes.
But how many groups there are here?
Yeah, I'm sorry. This is two stages, and I'm going to show you three stages, four stages. So that's two stages. I should have said that. For three stages, it's a very similar pattern, but the expected sample sizes come down a bit, because the more interim analyses we do, the better the expected sample size is.
I think the question was, what is the size of K?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, okay, this is for a four-arm trial.
Including the...
No, not including the control. So four arms plus control. Yeah. Sorry. This is for three stages, again for four arms. Similar pattern, really. And for four stages, basically we just see a small reduction in the expected sample size. So we don't actually gain a huge amount from doing more and more interim analyses. We get most of the benefit from just doing two interim analyses and having a three-stage design.
What impact does it have when the value of K?
Yes, we did look at this. So four is quite a standard number to use in practice. That you don't see really huge numbers of experimental arms considered. So we looked at 2, 4 and 6, and we found basically that there are more differences between the designs as the number of arms increased. So for example, the null optimal design would look better under the null when there are 6 treatment arms, and there was little difference under when there were only 2 experimental arms, and over here there's more difference as well. So that's all in the paper if you're interested in looking at the effect of how many treatment arms there are. And of course, the design the efficacy stopping boundaries become much more stringent when there's more arms because we're controlling the family-wise error rate, so we need to make a bigger correction. Futility boundaries tend to move up as well, which means we're more likely to stop early for futility for individual arms. Okay. So the next graph is again for a four-arm, two-stage trial. In this case, we're setting all of the treatment effects to be equal, and we're varying that. So this is when all of the experimental treatments are highly effective, and this is when none of them are effective. And we see very similar patterns, except perhaps a bit more difference in this case. So again, I like the delta minimax design here. It performs well for the whole range of values of delta. So that's for three stages and for four stages. So I thought I'd give a quick example. So it's all very well talking about the theory, but this has actually been done in practice, this type of design. So there's a trial being run by the MRC in London called the STAMPEDE trial, and this is being run in prostate cancer, and it has five stages and six arms, so five experimental arms and a control arm. So you can see the different arms they're using here. They've got a control arm, which is just hormone therapy, and they have hormone therapy plus different new treatments, and you can see some of the arms are combinations of these treatments. So that raises an interesting question about, you know, would you want to continue with this arm if both of the single agent arms were stopped, or vice versa? I think they do have some more complicated stopping rules in that case. But basically, if you're a patient, you're randomised between these arms at the start of the trial. So you have two patients on this arm for every one on the other arms. So it's a 2-1-1-1-1-1 allocation. I'll go into that a bit later about why we might use a deviation from equal randomization between arms. So they have an initial pilot phase. I'm sorry for the quality of this diagram. I should point out that both of these I've nicked from a nice paper by Matthew Sides, who is the trial statistician on this trial, and he's written a nice paper talking about practical issues and everything like that. He did actually want to come this evening, but he couldn't make it, unfortunately. It would have been good if he had, because he could add a lot to this discussion. So an initial pilot phase with 210 patients, and this is just to test whether any of the treatments are not feasible to recruit to, or if any of them have unacceptable safety profiles. So I think they've got to this stage or this stage now. They haven't finished the trial, but they've definitely got past this stage. None of the treatments were dropped at that stage. At the first activity stage, they're looking at something called failure-free survival, and this, notice that this isn't the same as the final endpoint they're using, which is time to, they're basically considering, you know, time to death at the end, but at the beginning they're considering what's called an intermediate endpoint called failure-free survival, which is, you know, once a patient has a failure or a progression, they're at a higher risk of death. So it's thought be informative for the death, but it's not quite the same, it's a correlated endpoint. So at this stage they compare each of the remaining arms to the control arm, and any treatment which has a hazard ratio of above 1, so any treatment that's worse than control would get dropped at that stage after that's a total of 1200 patients. Remaining arms would continue, so at 1800 patients they do another analysis, and this time the hazard ratio has to be better than 0.92, so you have to show a slight improvement compared to the control arm. And the final stage with failure-free survival is here at 2400 patients, and this is a hazard ratio of 0.89, so you have to get better and better as you go on. And I think they've dropped two of the five original arms, if I remember correctly. The final stage will be after they've got about 3,500 patients, and then they'll just test the effectiveness of each treatment against control for time to death.
If they dropped arms, presumably the total number of patients in the final analysis would be less?
I'm not actually sure about that. In the work I do, I always assume that the number of patients recruited per arm per stage is constant, so that if you reduce the number of arms, you reduce the total number of patients, but they seem to specify the total number of patients that they're going to recruit. Although, to to be fair, it says approximately 3,500 patients, so maybe they're taking that into account. I think they just continue until they've recruited 3,500 patients, and so if they've got a lot of arms left at the end, they'll have less power to detect any differences, whereas if they only have one or two arms at the end, they'll have higher power. I'm not 100% sure about that, to be honest, but I'm not sure what the best solution to that is, whether you should control the number of patients recruited to each arm at each stage, or just control the total number of patients that you have. I will come back to that a bit later, talking about random sample sizes versus fixed sample sizes. Any
another
more
question?
Yes, sure.
If you're changing the endpoint, doesn't that mess up your boundary calculations?
I don't know. I wasn't involved in this trial. So you have to assume a correlation between the endpoints. Assuming the correlation is correct, then your boundaries are fine. If it differs from what you, I'm not sure what they do in that case. Yeah, so I like the fact that they're using a different endpoint, because it means that you observe patients quicker, so you have more information at the interim analysis. I'm not sure if they've got it completely right in terms of the methodology. It's probably not the way I would do it if I'd designed it, but fair play to them, they've actually done it. I've not done a real trial like this, so I've got to give them respect for that. Any, yes?
When you drop the arm halfway through the first interim, we find that it's not good, but we cannot ask the patients to go, we have to continue the patients, and they will be in the trial.
You're saying patients who are on treatments who are dropped?
At that point, after that point, they've been treated.
Yeah.
So we have to keep them in the trial.
Yeah. That's a great question, yes. So patients who are on a treatment that gets dropped at an interim, so what happens to them, I think, depends on whether the treatment's dropped for lack of benefit or for safety concerns. So if it's dropped for safety concerns, they're definitely taken off it. And I think they're switched to the control treatment if it's dropped for lack of effectiveness. But then those patients won't count any further. They won't be included in any subsequent analysis. So, yes. Does that answer your question?
Less.
Yeah. But then again, you've dropped the treatment, so you're not interested in testing it again. So it doesn't lose any power, really. Okay. So you notice in that trial, they used an allocation of 2-to-1. So two patients on control, one on each experimental treatment. So work I did was, is this a good thing to do? Because you can show that, just to give you a rationale for that, the control arm is used in every comparison, so it kind of stands to reason that you might want to put more patients on that to get a better measure of, a better, more information about its effectiveness, because it's used in each comparison. And you can show for a trial with just one stage, so no interim analyses, that the optimal allocation ratio is approximately the square root of the number of effective treatments that you've got. So if you had four arms, you'd want to do a 2-to-1 allocation. But this might not be true for a multi-arm, multi-stage trial, because you're dropping treatments as you go along. So we were interested in whether they got it right, whether this 2-to-1 allocation was good for five stages and five experimental arms. Well, we did some work, and the optimal allocation does increase as the number of arms increases, as you'd expect, but it goes up much less slowly than the square root of k. So even with six arms, it's substantially lower than 2-to-1. So 2-to-1 is probably not putting too many patients on the control treatment, and you'd want to lower that if you're just interested in efficiency. But actually, the gains from doing this are pretty low, so about 10 for four experimental arms. So do we want to do it? Well, there's some research showing that the more likely it is that a patient gets a new treatment, the more likely they are to go on the trial, because probably patients want to go on a clinical trial to get new experimental treatments that aren't available. They could get the control treatment anyway. So is this small gain in efficiency worth it for relatively small gains? I'd say probably not.
Excuse me.
I think we also need to take into account the comments about control precedency results afterwards.
That might be a reason for increasing the allocation in that case, yes.
And maybe actually even to get credibility to investigators. Mm-hmm. So shift from the
Okay, but if you had more information on the control arm, arguably you could put fewer patients on the control arm in your trial because there's already extra information on them in the, I don't know, but
if you're a patient.
Okay.
Also, it depends on the delta between the control and the other one. So, if it's smaller, then of course, disproportionate numbers will not make a good outcome. If the difference is quite large, then you have to switch
around. Right, so you think it depends on the deltas?
Delta is also a part of the control.
Okay, that's interesting. I didn't really consider different values of delta. I know it depends on the variance, so if one of the arms has a high variance, then you might want to put more patients on that. But I hadn't thought of that, thank you.
Perhaps this is a question which is best saved towards the end.
Don't mind, I'm easy.
Sorry?
I'm happy to continue or take
it. But it occurs to me at this particular point, because given the fact that the trial, so to speak, changes, can change shape as you go along in what is at least partially a random way.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Evaluating its true performance given values for the efficacies is not simple.
Yeah.
So the question is going to be what sort of work has been done about that, and in particular I suppose one could simulate it and see what happens.
Yes.
You know, as arms drop off.
Yeah, so there are analytical formulae available for the simpler case of just the same endpoint used for each analysis. That's in the Biometrica paper in McGeer et al. Those are quite difficult formally to evaluate because they're multidimensional integrals of a function of multidimensional integrals. So simulation is often preferable in terms of speed. So I tend to use simulation myself. As long as you've got the analytical results to back up that, you know, for example, we're assuming that the family-wise error rate is controlled at delta equals zero, so when all of the experimental treatments are the same as the control, and there's an analytical result that shows that gives the maximum family-wise error rate, so controlling it at that point is the right thing to do. Yes?
Does a different allocation ratio have a different sample size?
Yes, exactly. So it would. So this is just the expected sample size that I'm looking at, but it also affects the sample size per group. It affects the sample size in the group. Well, for example, if you use the highly skewed allocation, so you put loads of patients on control, then you'd need a much higher group size for the experimental arms, because. That's not right. It would probably wouldn't affect the experimental arms hugely if you deviated the allocation ratio, but it would mean that you'd need a lot more patients on the control if you have a 4-to-1 allocation or something like that. So it increases the total number of... Well, if you start at equal randomization and you start increasing the control treatment, at the start you gain efficiency, the expected sample size and the maximum sample size used decreases, but then past this optimal point here, you lose efficiency, and as you go off to infinity, you get very low efficiency. You need very high sample sizes for the right power. Does that make sense? Okay. So that's the last bit on group sequential MAMS designs. I'm going to now move on to a second design, which is called the drop the loser design. So this follows from the fact that for a group sequential design, the sample size is random, because we're controlling the number of patients recruited per arm per stage. So for example, the design I showed earlier, the graph, had an expected sample size at some point of 292.5, and that was under the when all of the null hypotheses were true. So that's fine. But if you look at the distribution of the sample size, you see that the 95% quantile is much higher at 432. And in fact, if you look at the maximum possible sample size, it's something like 600. There's a little box plot here. So for example, in this case, this is the median sample size, but you can see that the total, the maximum sample size you could possibly use is huge compared to the median. So just going back. So this creates problems for when you actually want to use these methods in practice, because you need to specify how many patients you want to recruit. There's a high correlation between the cost of a trial and the number of patients that you need, because recruiting patients takes money and you need more and more centres open and things like that. So if you're doing an academic trial and you want to apply for money to do it, then how much money do you ask for when the sample size is random? You can't just ask for the average amount that you need, because sometimes you'll need more than that. And if you ask for the maximum you could potentially use, that's going to make it look very expensive, even if maybe you promise that you'll give some of the money back if you don't use it. And it also creates problems with logistics. For example, a lot of trials have to recruit people on temporary contracts. So you might have a 3-year or 5-year post. And if a trial stops halfway through that, what do you do with the staff you've still got? You know, if you're going to sack staff because of the results of trials, they might have an interest in changing the results of the trials so they'll still have a job. So although we might lose some efficiency on average from deviating from this random sample size, having a design that has a fixed sample size may be of great interest. So this led to the drop the loser design. So this basically sets, instead of setting futility and efficacy threshold on the test statistics, it specifies the number of treatments that will continue at each interim analysis. And generally you'd continue the treatments that have the highest test statistics at the interim, or at least assume that you do that at the design stage. The main advantage of this is that the sample size is fully known in advance, because you know exactly how many treatments are at each stage, and there's no variability in the sample size. So this is a three-stage design, so you've got three numbers. The first one tells you how many experimental arms you start with, that tells you how many arms you have in the second stage, and that tells you how many you have in the third stage. So a 4-2-1 design would look something like this, with the same kind of data as before. So again, we've got the four treatments here. This time we want to only continue with the two best treatments, so we continue with the black and the orange. We drop the other two, recruit more patients. Now we see this, and we only want to continue with the best treatment, so we continue with the orange. So there's no early stopping for efficacy in this case. We recruit a final set of patients, and we might see this test statistic. Now we compare it to some predetermined critical value, which determines whether we reject the null hypothesis or not. So again, I've done some work on this and compared it to a group sequential design, and we currently have a paper being revised that compares it. So it's not available yet, but if you ask me, I'll be happy to send you a draft. So this compares the sample size required for a drop the loser design compared to the random sample size used by a group sequential design. And it really does vary depending on how many arms you have. So here we have 4 experimental arms, and here we have 6 experimental arms. And of course, it depends on the true value of the treatment effect as well. So here is the global null hypothesis, where all of the treatments are ineffective. All of the experimental treatments have the same effect as the control treatment. And we see this box plot, which is, this is the median sample size used by the group sequential design compared to the fixed sample size used by the drop the loser design. And you see we have a medium increase in sample size needed compared to the median. Although it is less than the 75% point, so maybe 30 or 35% of the time a group sequential design will use more patients than the drop the loser design would under the global null hypothesis. Under the least favourable configuration, so now we have one effective experimental treatment, the gap is much lower here, so we hardly pay any price at all in terms of average efficiency for this fixed sample size. And as we increase the number of treatments to 6, well, we still pay a small price for the fixed sample size, but it's much less compared to here, and we actually make a gain under the least favourable configuration. So the price we pay for this fixed sample size varies depending on the number of arms. As you increase the number of arms, the drop the loser design becomes better. And also depends on the true value of the treatment effect. So for example, there would be cases where the sample size used by the group sequential design is much worse than this. And in that case, we'd get a bigger saving from the drop the loser design. And of course, if all of the treatments are highly ineffective or highly effective, then the sample size used by the group sequential design would be much lower, and we pay a much higher price for this fixed sample size. So the main advantage of this drop-the-loser design is this fixed sample size, and it's generally not too far away from the median of the group sequential design, and this should make it easier to plan studies. But it's got some disadvantages as well, and these are mainly to do with the inflexibility of the decision rules. For example, if we get to an interim analysis, so if I go back to here, and we're making a decision which treatment to continue, well, there's quite a big difference here, so we'd be fairly confident with going with the orange treatment. But what if the black treatment was very close? We'd be constrained by the design to pick the orange treatment, but it might well be that the black treatment's better and we're making a mistake. In another case, all of the experimental treatments might be ineffective, and perhaps all of the test statistics would be below zero. The design doesn't allow us to stop the trial in this case. It says you have to continue with the best ones, even if they're all highly ineffective. Of course, you can add a futility rule which says if they're all below some value, then stop the trial. That will affect your operating characteristics, but it affects it in an okay way. It will reduce the type 1 error rather than inflating it. So I don't mind adding a futility rule that addresses that problem at least. But still, we've got the problem with if the treatments are close together, you're constrained to go with one of them. There is a hybrid design by Nigel Stallard and Tim Frieder, and this basically uses ideas from the drop the loser design. It specifies the maximum number of treatments that can continue at each stage, but it also monitors the maximum test statistic, and if that's below some value, it will stop the trial for futility. And if it's above some critical value, it will stop the trial for efficacy if you want to. So this may be much more suitable, but retain many of the advantages of the fixed sample size. Okay, so that's the end of the group drop the loser bit. I'm going to just talk about one more design, adaptive randomization, unless there are any questions on drop the loser design. Okay. So adaptive randomization you may have heard of. I'm specifically talking about outcome adaptive randomization. This, in essence, is the idea that if you have several treatments and some are performing better than others, you should increase the allocation to the effective treatments and reduce them to the less successful treatments. So there's quite a big literature on this in two-arm trials, just one experimental treatment and the control treatment. And basically the consensus is that although this may lead to better average patient outcomes, so more patients get the better treatment if there is one, it lowers the statistical power a lot because it's deviating from the optimal one-to-one allocation ratio. And it's very controversial to use. Most people would not consider using adaptive randomization. But the multiple experimental arms gives us a way of addressing this. So if we set the allocation to the control group separately and just apply adaptive randomization to the experimental arms, then we still maintain, and in fact we increase, the statistical power, but we get some of the benefits from the adaptive randomization, that is, patients getting put on the treatments that are actually better. So higher patient outcomes, but maintaining the power. And this is only possible when there's in multi-arm trials. So it would look a bit like this. We'd start with equal allocation to each of the treatments. And at the first stage, again, we see the same data as before. So the orange treatment's performing really well, so let's increase the allocation for that. This is just a toy example. I'm making up the numbers, but it would look something like this. The light blue treatment's performing poorly, but we're not going to drop it. We're just going to set the allocation to quite a low value, so 5%. And you'll notice that the control allocation has gone up. That's because I'm assuming that we want to have the same number of control patients as the best experimental treatment, which will maximise the power for that comparison. But you could set it to remain at 0.2 throughout the trial if you prefer that. So
Yeah,
exactly. So this one's performing pretty poorly.
Do you think ethically anybody will let that happen?
Well, if you look at the confidence interval for the effective, it could go above zero, so it's not ruling out, but it's better than you know, maybe it'd be unfair to drop this treatment because it's actually not too bad, just by chance it didn't perform well. But the adaptive randomization procedure you use will allow you to take that into account. So if you want this to go to zero, it's possible. You can just use a different procedure. So you recruit more patients and you might see this. So now we're going to increase the orange allocation more, and also the control treatment, and the blue's performing pretty badly, and we've got more information here, so it might go down to a very low value, which means you might drop it entirely if it's below some threshold value. And finally, after the last patient is recruited, you compare these statistics of some predetermined critical value, so you can reject or not reject the null hypothesis. So another paper I've been working on compares adaptive randomization to a group sequential MAMS approach, and this is hopefully about to be published. So I compared this type of adaptive randomization with the fixed control group allocation to a group sequential MAMS procedure. Actually, the main result was they're actually surprisingly similar, which is quite a big result considering that most people think adaptive randomization is very low in power, whereas it's actually pretty good if you do this control group allocation tweak. So adaptive randomization is actually more efficient when there are effective experimental treatments, because you put more patients on the effective treatments and more on the control, which increases your power. And it's less efficient when none of them are effective, because you can add a futility stopping rule if you want, but it's still not as efficient as the MAMS design. One thing that adaptive randomization causes as a problem is that it complicates the analysis more than a group sequential approach. So for example, if you've got some kind of patient drift, maybe the treatment effect is changing over time because the standard of care is changing, or the patient characteristics of people who are entering the trial changes or something like that. If that happens, then adaptive randomization can experience problems, because if you think about it, if the treatment effect perhaps goes up over time and you're putting more and more patients on the experimental treatment that's performed best, then you might bias the results. Although setting the control group allocation to be equal to it kind of goes some way to dealing with that. So I'm not so worried about this as some people are, because if you choose the control group allocation cleverly, then it minimises the problem. And of course you can include extra covariates in the final analysis, which should take into account the changing in the treatment's effectiveness. One thing I like about adaptive randomisation is it's much more flexible when it comes to dealing with some things that cause loss of efficiency. So for example, delay between recruiting patients and assessing their treatment response. And if this is a very long delay, then it means that at an interim analysis you have less information than if you had a short delay, because a lot of the patients you've recruited so far haven't been assessed yet. So I should point out that all of these procedures don't really work very well when there's a long delay between recruitment and assessment, unless you've got some intermediate endpoint which is observed more quickly. So that's randomization. It's better at coping with delay, and it's better at coping with missing data, and it's also easier to include intermediate outcomes or patient subgroups. And in fact, the area where this type of design is used the most at the moment is the biomarker subgroup trials, where they're looking at several perhaps genetic biomarkers that are thought to determine the effectiveness of the treatment, and you want patients to receive the best treatment for their genetic profile. And in the States especially, there are a few trials that are using this type of design in that case, because I think it's more flexible.
You could have an interesting effect in this adaptive randomization. So mm-hmm. You have one treatment which at one stage is not doing very well, so it gets its allocation
yep.
reduced.
Yep.
But it still continues.
Yep.
Because of its smaller sample size, mm-hmm. its results are more variable. Mm-hmm. So it could leapfrog over a better one.
Yes.
And the better one could be dropped lower, and the
yeah.
worse one could be increased.
Yeah, that's an interesting point there. Maybe you see some switching, but yeah, eventually it will converge to the right.
If you go on long enough.
Yes, exactly. That's a good
so,
point.
So presumably, therefore, the amount of swapping around that goes on is some sort of index of how well determined your results are.
You're saying if it's swapped over a lot, then probably the treatment effects are quite similar yeah. in actuality. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Yeah, and in fact, it causes an interesting issue when it comes to estimating the treatment effects at the end, because if you imagine a treatment does very poorly by chance, much worse than its actual effect, and then you don't put any more patients on it, so there's actually a strong negative bias in treatment estimates at the end of the trial. That's as opposed to quite strong positive bias that you get from
you
normal groups.
Whereby the standard error of the treatment estimates is correlated the sample size.
Yeah.
It's correlated with the sample effect.
Yes.
Because, you know, higher sample effect, smaller standard error.
Yeah. That's true, yeah. Would that cause any problems, do you think?
Well, it could cause problems of interpretation.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, there is obviously merit in having a better treatment, better determined.
Yeah, so I think this is quite suitable for phase 2 trials where any treatment that you find will go on to a more standard phase 3 trial. And so, yes, there might be a few biases in the phase 2 trial which we're willing to put up with because of the increased efficiency. But if we were doing this in a phase 3 trial where we find any treatment we find to be effective at the end will go straight into practice, then that might be something we're less likely to be willing to do, yes. So I always recommend these types of designs for phase 2 trials or phase 3 trials that will have some subsequent trial validate what they're doing.
I mean, the number of new patients you're recruiting relative to the number of patients you've recruited is biggest in the best arm. So it's more likely that the best arm then change and go not so good because you're recruiting more patients than you had in the original.
Yeah, cohort. The worst arm will be more likely to stay where it is in terms of effect because you don't have any more patients.
The worst is more likely to stay where it is because you're not recruiting many patients.
Yeah.
And then you may need to stop from the poor arm because you're just never going to recruit enough patients to change that.
Yeah.
I do wonder with this, if you've got a very good arm and other arms that may be of interest, if you get the adaptive randomization correct, you may get an initial scenario where you've got a lot of patients on an arm which
you've already proven
is obviously good,
yeah,
and you get a ridiculously low p-value, which okay, but then you've got other arms which you then go up again. I wish you'd had more of those to determine if really those were some good or not.
Yeah, that kind of raises the problem of ethics and ethics versus efficiency, doesn't it? But you know, from an ethical point of view, you would want to put as many patients as you can on the best treatment. But for the efficiency of the trial and therefore ethics of future patients that aren't on the trial, you might want to put more patients on a second best treatment that you know, it might make the difference between finding a significant effect or not. So I'm interested in developing procedures that would maximise the total number of treatments found when there are multiple effective treatments. So that's something I'm interested in working on in the future, but haven't got round to yet. This works well when there's one effective treatment, and perhaps when there's several treatments with the same effect, you're not going to gain much over a multi-arm trial without interim analysis.
Most of the time, one effective treatment.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I mostly work in oncology and most new drugs in oncology don't work, so even one effective treatment would be good. You wouldn't often see many more than that. Okay, so these box plots just show again the sample size of a group sequential design. So the blue ones in this case are under the global null and the pink ones are under the least favourable configuration. This time I'm looking at different numbers of interim analyses or different numbers of analyses. So we start with 3, 5, and 10. The dashed line represents the sample size used by the adaptive randomization, which again is fixed. So we've got the same advantages as the drop the loser design had. In this case, you can see that with three interim analyses, sorry, I should point out this is 4 experimental treatments and 1 control treatment. So it's pretty much the same as the median under the global null for 3 interim analyses, but it gets worse as you increase the number of interim analyses. So the group sequential design is more efficient on average. On the other hand, under the least favourable configuration, where you've got a single effective treatment, the adaptive randomization sample size is much better than the sample size used by the group sequential design. Okay, so that was the last design I'm going to talk about, and I'll just finish with a conclusion. So hopefully I've at least got it across that multi-arm trials on their own provide a big gain in efficiency over separate trials, and hopefully I've given you a flavour of the different designs that we can use when we have interim analyses, and these can add further efficiency on average compared to just a multi-arm trial without interim analyses. Generally, the statistical performance isn't that different from the different designs, but they do each have their advantages and disadvantages. And one thing I have said, but I'll reiterate, is that all of these multi-arm, multi-stage designs become less efficient when there's a long delay between recruiting and assessing patients. So if we're looking at a trial like 5-year survival, then, well, by the time we know what happened to the first patient, we've recruited all the patients anyway, so there's nothing that we can change. If we have an intermediate outcome that gives us some information about long-term survival, then maybe these designs would still be useful. And also, when you've got a delay, the recruitment rate of the trial makes a big difference to the efficiency. So a slow recruitment rate means that you will have more patients available at the interim analysis than you would. Imagine if you recruited 1 million patients in a week, then you're not going to have any information at the interim analysis, whereas if you're recruiting 1 patient a week, you will have more information. So the relative advantage of these adaptive designs depends on the ratio of delay to recruitment rate. And so we are interested in more intermediate endpoints, because these will help us make decisions, especially early decisions in these type of trials. And just some references. So thank you very much for your attention. And I'm happy to take further questions if you have any.
The last point, the ratio between the response to recruitment, particularly you're working on oncology, where it's going to be fellow authors of different patient population, early cancers, late cancers, and recruitment faculty. Is there a way that we can advise the statisticians or clinicians to say, okay, if the ratio is like this, then we'll go for it, otherwise no point of
Well, you can certainly show the efficiency of the design as the ratio changes, which is something I've done in the past. So at beyond the certain ratio, if the recruitment rate is too fast, then you don't gain anything over a multi-arm trial, for example, and you can come up with a threshold, and you can say if you expect the recruitment rate to be faster than this, then don't do the trial, but if you expect it to be slower, then do it. But actually, a lot of clinicians are quite optimistic about the recruitment rate, so maybe that wouldn't be a great thing to do, because the actual recruitment rates are often slower than planned. But yes, it's definitely possible to come up with a threshold at which you gain.
Just to say that this is being made, this number is achieved.
Yeah, I doubt that you can come up with a number that works in every scenario, but you could certainly, it would depend on a lot of other things as well, like the number of arms and power and the effect size you're powering the trial for and things like that.
But that all fits for a design.
Yeah. So for a particular design, you can certainly say yes.
Whether to go for adaptive randomization or not.
Yeah.
That decision can be made.
Definitely. But with a multi-arm trial without interim analyses, it's always going to provide the same efficiency over separate trials, because you don't have any interim decisions to make, you just wait until you've recruited all the patients. So you always gain a lot from multi-arm trials, not necessarily so much from multi-arm, multi-stage.
Yeah, I mean, on the last point there, I think it's important to stress the choice of the intermediate endpoint, the correlation between the
precisely, yeah, very good point. If it's not giving any information on the final endpoint, then there's no point including it. If it's, yeah, you want to highly, at least medium correlated. I think in the Stampede trial, which I talked about earlier, I think they assumed the correlation was about 0.5 or 0.6, and they thought that was enough to make it worthwhile using. So it doesn't need to be one or anything, but it needs to be at least mediumly high.
Another question I have is, I mean, it's all relevant for phase two, but maybe from your experience, from what you know, how will the regulators willing to accept
that? Yes. So they talk a lot about accepting it, but aren't so accepting in reality. So if you wanted to do this for a phase three trial, then the FDA and the European Medicines Agency say you need strong control of the family-wise error rate, which means the maximum family-wise error rate for any treatment effect over all configurations is controlled at the level like 5% or whatever. Now for group sequential designs, the first design I talked about, that's possible to do. So you just control the family-wise error rate at when all of the treatments have the same effect as a control, and that is the maximum. That's an analytical result that can be proven. The drop the loser designs, actually, in work I submitted, I couldn't prove it. I did some simulations that showed it's probably the case, but couldn't prove it. And one of the reviewers said, here's a proof. They gave me a 5-page proof. I've never seen such a helpful reviewer in my life. But, yeah, so that's proved in that case as well. So adaptive randomization, on the other hand, it's not been proven yet that the maximum family-wise error rate is when all of the treatments have the same effect as the control treatment. So what I'm trying to get across is maybe adaptive randomization would be less acceptable to use in that phase three setting because you can't show that the family-wise error rate is controlled at the level that you say it's controlled at. It might be higher. I think it's not higher. I think controlling it at zero will control it, but I'm not sure about that.
You would have to
You have to conclude what's it?
Blocking the changes in randomization ratios.
Yeah.
As you get tighter.
But if you can prove analytically that it controls the family-wise error rate, then I don't see any reason that the regulators wouldn't accept it. I suppose one reason is possibly that you need to unblind the data to do interim decisions, which is something that they're not so keen on. But if you have some good firewall set up so that the person doing the interim analysis isn't connected with the people actually treating patients, then should be okay. But most of the multi-arm, multi-stage trials at the moment are open-label trials where they're not blinded anyway. It's difficult to blind in this case.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the differences.
Yeah.
If it's open-label, physically changing the randomization ratios of investigator
names. Yes, that's true. Yeah. Yeah, a clever clinician can realise that the allocation is getting higher, so that treatment must be better. So maybe that's another point against it.
Or they randomly get more of one treatment and think it's higher.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
But this presumes, of course, that the clinician is aware of that the design or a design like that is being used.
Well, they would have to be, they'd have to agree to be part of the trial. I mean, if they understand it, of course.
You can keep some details of the design secret, and you can keep changes in the application ratio secret, but you have to deal with the general nature of the trial, the fact that the ratios change.
Yeah, I think So in a different type of adaptive design called sample size re-estimation, it's often criticised because a clinician could figure out exactly the effect size seen in the first stage from the sample size used in the second stage. I've never met a clinician who would actually sit down and do that calculation, so I'm not sure if this is such a big problem in reality. But,
I don't think they would do that.
No.
Yeah. I did see one trial, where a physician figured that his patients would be best at getting the average of two treatments, so he opened two packets and gave four treatments after one half of the other.
That's the ethical thing to do, isn't it?
Well, it might have been best for his patients,
yeah.
Possibly.
Not very good for the trial.
No.
Well, I don't think you can do much about that type. They're going to find a way to do that kind of thing. Yeah. Any other questions?
Well, if there are no others, just one quick question.
Yeah.
What does STEM mean to STEM?
Not sure. It'd be something very convoluted, wouldn't it?
Okay.
Was it prostate cancer?
It was prostate cancer. So yeah, presumably the P is prostate cancer. I'm sorry, I'm not exactly sure, but that okay. Paper's available if you want to look at it.
Just wondering, but sorry I asked. Thank you very much. I'm sorry, there was another question.
If the drop the loser, you mentioned this, if you went two treatments close.
Yeah.
As you inferred in the first part, if you drop a treatment, this can often be an almost irrevocable patch.
Mm-hmm.
Especially in an open label trial.
Yeah.
And this must be a big problem for this. Because you can proceed with one treatment and find it's not the best, and you've sort of burnt your bridges in trying to to fully investigate the second one.
That's definitely the biggest criticism that people make when I give talks about the drop the loser design. They don't like the inflexibility of the decision rules that you need. The same thing is true for the group sequential design. If it's just below the futility boundary, then a lot of clinicians won't want to drop it. Yeah, exactly. But it's probably less important in that case. Then. Yeah. Precisely. Yeah, I agree.
Well, that was a nice introduction for complex situations. So once again, thank you very much.